This is Vulnerability Matters from the Money Advice Trust.
That's something that we found super helpful, hearing them tell us how they became aware of that issue. And it really is from those frontline colleagues saying, I have a person and I'm not able to communicate with them.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to Vulnerability Matters. I'm Chris Fitch. Imagine receiving a letter that looks official, important, potentially urgent, but being unable to read it. For over 1 million people in England and Wales who do not speak English as their first language or at all, this is potentially an everyday reality. And it's one where household bills, key information, and debt repayment notices can go unread and unacted upon. Joining us today to discuss this is Louise Alemania from the Credit Services Association, the trade body representing over 200 different debt collection and debt purchase firms. And we've just launched a new report which reviews what is known about such customer language barriers, mapping translation interpretation activity in the debt advice and debt collection sector, and which is also informing a new programme of work at the CSA to bring together language support organisations with creditors and debt advice agencies. Louise, welcome to Vulnerability Matters. Really delighted to have you here. The Credit Service Association have got a new report out which focuses on how organisations can better work with customers who have language barriers. Before we dive into the definition of language barriers, just interested in how did this report come about? Why now?
The origins of the report are quite telling in themselves. Our head of policy at the CSA was approached by a neighbour a little while back who has a language barrier and who wanted to get some help with translating and signposting to financial advice. And that kind of just sparked the interest internally, because the question then became, well, how many people are in this position? So that's how it came about. And I think the very fact that the neighbour kind of had to, I guess, like desperately almost say, like, can you help me here, speaks to what the problem probably looks like in reality.
And that's often the way, isn't it? When it comes to vulnerability, our personal and our professional lives don't sit separately. And the things that we see and notice in our own lives can often be the drivers or the catalyst for changes that we seek to make in our working lives and for the customers that we're working to support. So the report is using the term language barriers. So Louise, is there a common definition that we should all be aware of when we use this?
The technical way that I describe language barriers would be any obstacle that prevents a person from being able to communicate in the main language in the place that they're occupying. That's the very technical definition, I guess. But I would like to say that language barriers exist on a scale. So what a language barrier looks like for one person will be completely different for another person. One person might be able to communicate quite easily on basic things to do with their financial account, for example, whereas another person might struggle to, you know, read a complex financial letter or a complex financial piece of information. So I think it's important to highlight that it's a scale.
Absolutely. And how common a problem is this?
It's a really good question. And frustratingly, there's not a concrete answer that I can give to that. So is this piece of work, we did a research review, we looked at existing statistics and data, and then we engaged stakeholders. So there isn't, what we found, there isn't one central place that defines the scale of language barriers in the UK. The last data that's available is from the ONS, but that's from 2021. And what it tells us is that 1.5% of the population couldn't speak English well, and 0.3% of the population couldn't speak English at all.
Okay, so those figures come from the 2021 census. And in 2021, the population of England and Wales was 60 million. So doing a quick bit of maths here, the 1.5% of the population who said they cannot speak English well is about 880,000 people. And the 0.3% who said they cannot speak English at all is about 161,000 people. And if you're wondering, there was a free translation service available for the census. So that's how they would have probably completed the survey. So that's just over 1 million people in England and Wales that might be facing language barriers. So I guess the question, Louise, is with these barriers in mind, what practical problems might this be causing for financial or essential services?
So that's a really, really interesting question. And it's something we were really keen to understand. From speaking to stakeholders and to firms, it can really be a range. So for a lot of people, they will ask a family member or friend to translate on their behalf. That's obviously a workaround for some people, but I think we have to be aware of economic abuse. So we know that language barriers can actually be a trigger for economic abuse. And that's the most nefarious end of the scale. But we also see instances of children translating for their parents. And if I think about some of the letters that are sent in financial services, the complexity of the terms, I think the risk's quite obvious. The risk is that the translation doesn't fully capture the communication. And that's what we know about because we see that happening. What we don't know is the people who receive letters that they simply just don't understand and aren't able to pick up the phone or write an email. Therefore, their challenges, you know, I couldn't say what they'd be like, but there must be a pool of people who aren't able to communicate at all enough to say that they have a language barrier.
And there's a difference here, isn't there, between speaking some English and engaging with the type of often quite difficult information maybe financial or essential services might share with a customer. Because looking at the same census data for 2021, we touched on before, there is a group of people who do speak English, about 4.1 million, but not as their main language. And I guess that can create language barriers when those communications from a company or an organization might be complex or difficult to engage with and understand. Okay. Now, as part of your review, you mapped out how both debt advice organizations and CSA members, and that's over 200 firms working in debt collection or debt purchase, were dealing with the challenge of the language barriers that we touched on. So what did you find out and why should we perhaps be concerned?
So I guess it builds on from the fact that we don't have any concrete information that tells us the number of people who are in financial difficulty and who have a language barrier. Because there's a lack of information available within the industry itself, so much so that when we spoke to different debt charities and different debt organizations, there was a lack of clarity around which debt charities can offer a translation service. And that wasn't just amongst firms, that exists amongst debt charities themselves. There was just a lack of clarity about who can actually provide a translation service. For example, PayPlan offer translation services, but we didn't know that going into it. Citizens Advice do as well. But we had a lot of people saying to us, different charities offer translation services, when in fact they actually didn't. And that in itself could manifest as a real problem because signposting is quite hard anyway. You have to explain the concept to someone who might be new to it, to a customer. You have to get them bought into it, and then you have to get them to the right person. If you actually send them to someone who can't offer a translation service, you can see how disengagement might just become more entrenched.
So if you're involved in debt collection or you're an essential services organization, you might have done some work with the client. Maybe you've done some translation or interpretation yourself. You then signpost them to a debt charity in good faith that they can deliver the same type of service, only for the client then to kind of find out that's not the case.
Yeah, that could be a possibility. I mean, I think what's good about this piece of work is we now know explicitly which charities offer translation services and what those translation services are. So it seems like quite a small finding, but I think we're really pleased with this because at least we can say to our members that this is who you could signpost to if you have someone with a language barrier, which it turns out was actually a gap.
And I thought it was really interesting in your report that the Institute of Money Advisors research that you cite, that showed that 50% of UK debt advisors worked with non-English speaking clients, with 11% doing this daily and 39% weekly. So clearly this is a common challenge across the debt advice sector. But I guess we have to remember that debt advice services all have different resources and different ways of operating. So a National Debt Line or Step Change type debt agency can have a very different way of engaging with clients compared to maybe a Christians Against Poverty or maybe even a Citizens Advice approach, which can often more associated with face-to-face advice. Anyway, you spoke to members of the CSA as well about language barriers. So what were they encountering and what did you find there?
So we actually surveyed our members, and of the 42 that we surveyed, 16 engaged and explained that the language barriers that they encounter. So 14 firms said that they experience and recognize language barriers as being a challenge. And most of them have policies in place to deal with that. The challenge that our members face is in being able to identify that information. So obviously, if you're a debt purchaser or a debt collection firm, you've inherited an account. You're not going to necessarily know about a language difference unless it's been disclosed and passed on to that debt collection or debt purchase firm. That was a key thing that came through, which was a lot of our members actually do have translators there and ready, or their policies recognize language barriers and are ready to respond to them. But it's the actual identification that's really, really difficult. And having that conversation to say, is there a language barrier and could we instigate our translation service?
It is a challenging call to make when you're engaging with someone and trying to identify what support they might need. It could put a lot of organisations off, couldn't it?
Certainly could. We did talk about what some solutions could be. And because of that, we spoke to LanguageLine, we spoke to RecitMe, and the Association of Translation Interpreters. And what we found from that was there was a couple of different suggestions about things firms could explore. For example, letters being sent, so like welcome letters, with a line explaining that if you have a language barrier, you can let us know. And it could be like a QR code, or it could be a way to email or something like that. But in debt purchasing, a welcome letter is always sent when a debt's assigned. And that could be a really nice place to just put it out there that there's support available.
You see that within the public sector, local authorities often, and also government agencies will also have that kind of line or information on their on the letters and communications that they send out. There was also some consideration about family and friends often having to translate for customers. What did the research say about that?
So this is the thing that was, I think, really quite concerning, which was, a lot of people will ask a friend or a family member to translate on their behalf. I was reading a piece of work by the government actually recently, and it was saying that language barriers are one of the triggers that make people vulnerable to economic abuse. It could be somebody intentionally misinterpreting information, or it could be someone simply innocently misinterpreting it. And we did hear from some debt charities and some members that often people want to use a family member and a child to translate on their behalf. And it's like I said before, I look at financial letters all the time as part of my job. And even I sometimes have to pause and come back to them and get a second opinion, because they're naturally technical, they have to be. But what is the likelihood of translating something with perfect accuracy to another person? I really question that, especially when the risks of being in debt and the importance of taking action are so, you know, they're such big things.
And the added challenge of a child translating this information as well. Plus, we know from the government's economic abuse toolkit that, as you mentioned earlier, language barriers can significantly increase the risk of economic abuse by forcing maybe survivor victims to rely entirely on their partners for communication, financial management, or legal understanding. And this can be exploited by abusers who might misinterpret those financial documents, maybe withhold information about rights, and even isolate victim survivors from independent support services. But are there other risks that might be introduced in terms of potential vulnerable situations being missed during a conversation or an engagement?
Yeah, so I'll speak speculatively here because we didn't look into this specifically, but I think we can make some inferences, shall we say, because we know that a lot of people will experience different vulnerabilities, and we know that not speaking English proficiently can be a trigger in itself. If we then put ourselves in the shoes of someone who maybe has a mental health challenge or an illness, for example, I think the question arises as to how does the language barrier exacerbate that, or vice versa. Could it be a compounding factor for somebody who's already struggling to engage because of a mental health challenge, for example? I can only speak speculatively, but that would be my feel on that.
Because you have these intersecting issues, and sometimes we will talk about vulnerability in terms of single issues, mental health or learning disability or financial resilience, but we're messy bundles as individuals, and all of these things can come together. Now, one of the key findings in the report is that, as you said earlier, language needs are not binary. It's a much wider spectrum of where we might need support. So based on your research, do you have some insight to how firms might structure their recording of information about language needs, or to more accurately capture what support the individual might need?
So I'll speak in the sense of, because we've not been able to quantify the problem as well as we would like to because of the available data, it will be for every individual firm to decide what's proportionate for them. And they will know the type of debts that they buy, for example. So they'll know, they'll have an idea of, are they more likely to have customers with language barriers? But a lot of our members do already have processes in place to record language as a barrier. I don't know if we go as far at the moment to record the level of barrier, i.e. does it mean someone needs a translator or not, but that could be something that firms could consider, because it is a scale, as you just said. So is it a case of letters need to be issued in a different language? Is it a case of we need to appoint a third party? But we do know that a lot of firms already do that. To go back to my earlier point, I actually think a really good starting point would be having a clear list of who you can signpost to and having a process in place that allows you to do that signposting, which will be individual for every firm. But I think if you bring together the ability to record the information, potentially on a scale, if you know who you can signpost to, and you have a procedure that your frontline colleagues are familiar with that allows you to signpost, they could be some really basic but important things to start with, I think.
In the report itself, there's a lot more detail around some of the provision from debt advice charities. And hopefully what you're saying is making people think about language needs as a support need, because often it's not as unpacked as other categories of support. The report also points out that a lack of language support could cause zero engagement. It's like meaning debts remain completely unresolved simply because the customer can't read the letter or the text message or the email.
Yeah.
What can we do about this? How can we address this?
I think that's a really difficult question to answer, and because it is the reality, right? We have a lack of data available about the scale of language barriers, especially in financial services. It's probably quite hard to gather that data, I'm realizing now. But then you do have that risk of someone receiving a letter or picking up the phone and hearing someone speaking a language you don't understand and just thinking, I can't engage. I guess going back to that earlier suggestion, the welcome letter is probably, I'd like to think, a good place. I suspect there'll be an element of trial and error for firms if they want to try and take this on, to try and understand if that makes a difference. But the honest answer is, I don't know specifically what we can do about that. I think what we have to do is recognize there's a barrier and try and find ways of letting people know that we have the provisions in place or can put provisions in place to make conversations more accessible.
So where can we get the report, and what practical steps can firms take to better support customers where English is not their first language?
So the report is available on our website, and the steps that firms can consider are all within the report itself. There are things that we've talked about. So I would say, what can firms do? I think engage with the report would be a really good starting point. We will actually be holding a workshop for our members in the next few months, where we're going to bring together those debt charities that offer translation support, plus those organizations like Recite Me and Language Line, to just talk about operationally the practicalities of communicating with people who don't speak English, So firms that are interested might want to take a look at that workshop when it comes around. But yeah, I would look at policies first and foremost. What do you have in place? What does your data tell you at the moment? What do your frontline colleagues tell you? Do they have insights into how often they encounter language barriers? That's something that we found super helpful when we spoke to deaf charities, hearing them tell us how they became aware of that issue. And it really is from those frontline colleagues saying, I have a person and I'm not able to communicate with them.
And I guess that call to speak to those around you, to speak to the frontline, to speak to deaf advice agencies, takes us full circle back to where we started this conversation about the neighbour talking to a head of policy. So on that note, thank you ever so much, Louise, and we look forward to following this with enormous interest. And that was Louise Alemagna from the Credit Services Association. You can find the CSA's report, Signposting for Customers Who Have Language Barriers, at www.csa-uk.com. And if you're also interested in the government's economic abuse toolkit, which was mentioned today too, the easiest way to find this is a Google search for Government Economic Abuse Toolkit V2. That's about it for today. So until next time, brush up on your polyglottery, mind your language, and always remember that vulnerability matters. Vulnerability Matters was brought to you by the Money Advice Trust. It was presented by Chris Fitch and produced by Phil King.